This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, but we're on location. We are here with Vales Shepherd, who has written a fascinating new book, nothing like it already in print. Hi, Vales, and what is the title of the book?
Morning. The title is A Good Ending for Bad Memories. Sorry about that. I was thinking maybe it's afternoon, but A Good Ending for Bad Memories.
The book, though, will transcend all time zones, no problem. And just for starters, this is a complex book for a first debut novel. I can't imagine how much you put on your plate. I just want to say the main character, a main character, is a mother with multiple personalities, just for starters, and the children must respond to those different elements. Tell us a little more about it. That's just for starters. A lot more happens in this book.
Well, you know, it came to me because I think for me, linear characters don't interest me as much. That's one thing. But the real thing is this woman has an antecedent who was a slave known as Two for the Price of One, and Celsie is her other name. And she created her sisters, in other words, her other personalities, to help her deal with the day-to-day trauma of being a slave. There was no diagnosis or treatment at the time. And then a few generations later, the same thing was going on with her great-granddaughter. And for that reason, she is really sort of rifling through her past to try and understand why she needed to create these sisters. And so it's the story goes on between both of them, kind of telling their story on their way to healing.
It is an amazing work. And not only do we have that degree of difficulty, but we have a story which crosses continents. Weren't you satisfied to keep it in one location? What adds to the dimensions by going to a different country?
Well, one of the reasons that I wanted to set the story in a place where there wasn't a regular interaction with the mother, because she wouldn't be free to explore herself and her past if there were several other things that she always had to do, you know, to interact with her neighbors and things like that. In the attaché, they lived in a mansion in the western part of Cairo, Egypt, where Americans and others that were living there for a time lived, and she had servants. So she had people to take care of the children, the house, her husband, in a way that freed her up, really, to be able to explore her history. But the one thing that I think that's important that helps me tell the story is that when she's rifling through the past, she does it orally, and she wants the children to be present to listen. And the children see this as a way to really try and understand this character. They don't understand their mother. They know they love her. They know they think of her as just a moody person. And so they always want to be present when she's speaking about the mountain where she grew up, which they have no sense of in the very beginning. They just hear the stories of it from her.
How did you know the customs in another country so well?
Well, first of all, my bucket list is like, I want to see the entire world. I have a friend, a very close friend, my closest friend, who happens to be from the Middle East. And though she's Lebanese, she grew up in Jordan. And we spent time, I would go home with her in the summers. But the other thing is, my husband and I went to Egypt. We went for our honeymoon. We want to go back. We had a fascinating time. So, and part of it's research. Most of it is finding a place you love, then learning more and more about it, and then learning enough to know where you can put your imagination. So, if point A is true and point E is true, then the story has to carry on my imagination from one true point to another. So I think that's
I hope helps. Everyone heard that really closely. To find a place, research it, make it true, and then a place where your imagination can go. What a terrific way to describe it. I've never heard something like this.
Thank you. Well,
it has so many layers. Did you progress with a storyline and then all of the richness just came from your deep well? Or did you have four different manuscripts that you tried to blend in and braid in?
No, I was lucky in this sense because, to be honest with you, I knew the ending. I knew I was going to have an ending like that. And then the rest kind of, you start, at least for me, you start a story. And as you develop the characters, and these characters definitely sort of, after they began, they develop themselves. And like the characters, I'm a walker. So I would walk and they would, you know, talk to me and they would, you know, help me tell this story. And so I knew where I was going. The trouble is the middle. The middle is what gets big. And then you have to try to pull it back to get it to a place that it's understandable. And the one thing that I knew that I thought would be helpful to the reader is that each of the characters appears in the same order. And that would help you, kind of give you a key. They do not, you know, one than the other. And that happens throughout the book. And I hope that's helpful for the reader. I really do.
I think that being an editor, it didn't hurt you a bit in writing this book, because you're very precise. You're very organized. You're very clear. And you know how to parse things. So all of that is in your DNA. But it's just the, you know, like Whitman says, there are multitudes inside of this book. Tell me how many characters there are.
Well, first, may I say something about you, Grace? May I say something about what you've been doing for many years?
I want to vet it first.
Well, what I wanted to say is, Grace, the use of words, the magical language that you possess, I think everybody should read everything you've ever written. And I have to say that, you know, I used to spend Sunday mornings with Grace's work, and they were magical, and it was lovely. And Grace, quite frankly, I think you help. I think you've influenced me in the way that you read and write poetry, and particularly, which I'm most familiar with, in the way you talk about others' poetry. So let me get that out there. First.
Okay, we're done here. I'm leaving. I got everything I came for. Listen, thank you. We've known each other. And I do want to touch on your career as a publisher, which we will do later, because that's where we intersected, to the great good, to my great good. How many characters are in this book?
Well, if you, the main person, the main character has five personalities, but one of them, and see, I don't want to be a spoiler, so I'm not going to tell you anything more except, okay, so it's her, then she's the main character along with her husband, and they together with their three children move to Cairo, Egypt. The backstory, when she begins to talk about her antecedents, is her great-great-grandmother, who was the slave known as Two for the Price of One, who also had multiple personality disorder, and then it's just her mother. And that's basically that. Oh, and you'll meet the grandfathers and the great-grandfathers, sort of tangentially, just to tell you that they existed and how they interacted with the women.
For people who do not know about the art of writing, each character has a storyline to the other character. So if we had a string going from the mother to each of the children to each other, Mr. Thrace, we have a string. It would look like a massive basket of strings. So the writer has to keep that afloat between each person. And did you do it with, like in the old days, we used to put index cards up all over the wall. What was your process?
Well, the great thing is that, as I said, that the characters formed, and they formed well. And so they were never confusing to me, because each of them had particular aspects of themselves, things that they did, things that the other did not do. And each of them related to the children in a certain way. And so that made it simpler to keep those strings afloat. And then the one chronological line in the story was family life, moving to Egypt, living and working there. And then when his term of duty was over, coming back. And I think that helped. And I, you know, Grace, you asked me before about how to go to different cultures. I think that may have helped, because it helps them interact. And you'll see the character grow and how she spends her time in one place or another. And so that may have helped, but the children only traveled from Egypt and back to Washington, D.C. And then, so I got to focus on them in one place. And then the brother, who traveled back to the mountain where she grew up, which kind of helped reinforce that original story, I think, in some ways, the backstory.
Well, I would like to know, and I'm sure everyone else would, the day this got a hold of you, the day that this germ, this little seed was planted that you watered for all this time, when did the idea occur? How long did it incubate? What was your discipline in writing it?
What's the last part? What was?
Your discipline, your daily methodology.
Oh, okay. So, you know, for me, this is going to sound, I don't know how this is going to sound, But I felt like in this story in particular, it was like a recipe and I had all these ingredients. So I knew that that I had to set a part of it in Egypt because of my love for that place. And of course, my love for Washington, D.C., which is part of it. I grew up in a neighborhood where these two old spinster sisters lived and we would get glimpses of them. And someone said to us that, oh, their father was one of the first African-American attachés to ever be assigned abroad. And so in looking at them, something about them stayed with me. The other thing is years ago, and I think it may have been the New York Times, but in all honesty, I don't remember anymore. I read an article written by a woman who actually suffered from multiple personality disorder, and it was fascinating. And they nowadays, some people don't believe it's true. They've changed it. They call it dissociative disorder or something, but reading about her was so fascinating to me, it stayed with me. So then I began to do the research, and it began to sort of jibe in that way. There's one other thing, and that is part of what I thought about is, you know, how cruelty manifests itself in our world and how I think it cuts both ways so that people that practice it and the victims of it are forever damaged by it. And I think that that's true in our society. And I think slavery was this, I hate to say it this way, but the focal point, because the slave would have witnessed a daily amount of cruelty that would cause her to, you know, to be able to have to create these other sisters to be able to live in her world. And then imagine the great-great-granddaughter a couple of decades later experiences the same things to manage the trauma in her own life. And the unfortunate part about the way humans work is trauma stays with us. Trauma is what we remember. Of all the good things that happen to us, somehow or another, the trauma is indelible. And I wanted to talk about it in a way that maybe we could change it. So all of those things kind of came together, and that's what I wanted to write about. So for me, I am an early riser. I'm a farmer's daughter. I don't know why. You know, my dad did do some farming, but not much. And I wake up early. And so for me, that the writing hours are usually at 5 a.m. until whenever the day starts and I have to get up and go. And sometimes that's far too short. So when I had to do, and most of this book, I believe, was written that way, the 5 a.m. shift. So if I had 2 hours in the morning, I would stop exactly when I knew what was going to happen next, because when I came back the next day, that meant I could move faster through the story. I never liked to stop when I didn't know what was coming. I liked to stop when I knew what I was going to do next, because then, you know, you kept the fluidity. You could go right into it and preserve the time a little bit better. And then a lot of times in the evenings, I would come back, look at what I wrote, try to see if it's okay for me to move on from.
A Good Ending for Bad Memories is the name, and we're talking to Vals Shepherd, who is the author of a debut book, which does more in one volume than 10 books put together, and she manages to do it. And it glows with some inner strength, something she wanted to say that is bigger than language. And that's what illuminates this book. So one thing I do want the audience to know is if you write good characters, you can always pick them up and they'll go where they need to go. Everything is character. Everything is character. And you do that. Would you read us a couple of pages from this book?
Sure.
A Good Ending for Bad Memories by Vals Shepherd.
So I want to, you know, I'm reading from further in the book. And it's just when the young son in the family finds his grandparents. His grandparents' house wasn't on a predictable road. He didn't know exactly where she lived, but he knew the name of her town, and he only needed to ask once for them to point him towards the woods. He came up upon both her houses and sat out front, wondering on which door to knock. He saw a little movement in the newer-looking house and tried the door. The new house seemed the most welcoming. An old man opened the door and motioned for him to come inside quickly. She's still pretending that she don't know I'm here. Black was too afraid to think that it had been this easy to find the man he was looking for. Are you Mrs. Aberdeen's neighbor, or is this her house? Or we'll get to that, boy. Come on, make some noises that sound like a house. Can you squeak or something? Black laughed and tried. He had walked in on something else he didn't understand. Now, boy, you ain't got to arrive at all easy like. Your grandma's been expecting you. Black was even more astonished when the old man seemed to know him. She's going to tell you that the trees told her you was coming. But the truth is, she just wanted it so bad. She had been wanting to see you all ever since you've been gone. She ain't seen you since you was a baby. Did you come alone? She's going to say she was expecting you, but she'd have taken what she could get. The old man caught his breath. Round about now, I like to go up and then back down the stairs. Make it sound drafty, wind blowing through an empty house. Now, you go on and tiptoe back and forth round the top of the house. Black did what he was told, peering into two empty rooms and a third one that was being used for storage. The room had all manner of boxes, all unopened, big and small. Boxes, some torn a little, but mostly still wrapped the way they must have arrived. There were letters as well, but only the boxes interested Black. He was looking at the labels when the old man called up to him. You're not tiptoeing. Make some creaking noises. You can do it with your mouth if you can't do it with your feet. He could hear the old man chuckling in his old man raspy voice, and he didn't know if he thought something else was funny or if he was making fun of him. He heard him talking. She's going to think the house got married and brought a spouse home.
You know, as I listen to this, I realize how much your history, your own personal history, factors into being able to write this. Because I remember when you were working with substance abuse people and you were working as an addition to your 9-to-5, every day you gave your weekends up to help these people. So there, the idea of trauma is very vigilant in your life. I also know that you work for the African Discovery Organization. Is that the name of it?
African Development Group.
Development Group. Therefore, mm-hmm. You're immersed in a culture, which I'm sure from your vast reading knowledge as an editor and publisher, you already had a lot of thinky knowledge. But your immersion in that development group also gave you some heft, I think, for this book. Because I want to tell you, I just love the language. Shut up, cake. Balloon boy. Just the way they talk. There is in you a puck. Shakespeare's puck is in you. You're such an elf. You're such a little, you are just so mischievous. You're just so playful. What well is inside of you where all this magic happens? It's so reality. This book is levels of reality, psychological dissonance, surreality, folklore, fairy tale, legend, and sheer playfulness. Sheer playfulness. Talk about the language of these people. Where did that come from? You're many years away from that talk.
You know, I don't even know how to, I don't know how to explain. I will tell you one thing about me is I think I learned my lessons and they stay with me, you know, so that when I think about the African Development Group and traveling to Africa, first I want to clear up something. I was never a publisher. I was always an editor. And for the Washington Independent Review of Books, I was the senior features editor for a while.
Oh, but so, we have to jump in and clarify that really fast because okay. This is a station break here. The Washington Independent Review of Books is the foremost review editorial journal in this country right now. I just have to say that Vales Shepherd is one of the people who founded this when the Washington Post ceased to review books. Mm-hmm. And so Vales was one of the core staff of this publication, which is the Washington Independent Review of Books, which is going on now.
Yeah,
so
it is.
I call you a publisher in that you formed the structure for this to happen. So now we'll go back to our other conversation.
Okay. So when I worked at the African Development Group, and that was years ago, I feel like that was my first big job. And, you know, it was a company that was where two partners were doing business in Africa, and they would help people that wanted to do different things. And one of the things that they did was build the largest poultry farm while they were there. And it was always like these people would bring in some expertise, funding, and then work it out on the ground so that the owners and the people that were actually working were all, you know, Africans that wanted to do this business. And most you could come to, you know, and it worked both ways. They would bring ideas and people would bring ideas to them. The lovely thing about it is one of the partners is a gentleman who wrote a book called The African Safari, and I got to be editor on that book, which required the group to go on safari. And that was one of the most magical things I've ever experienced in my life. When you see nature at work, the way it's supposed to work, you know, shy of any sort of influence or sort of any collusion by man. It's incredible. Like one day you'd drive up and there'd be 22 lion eating 2 Cape buffalo. And 3 days later, the only thing there is the white skull bones that are inedible. And everything would have taken its turn. And that, you know, it's a sort of watching nature at work. First the lions and the jackals and the hyenas and the foxes and the, you know, finally down to the hyenas and the insects. I mean, it's an incredible, and birds. I forgot about the birds, which would play a major role. But it is definitely something that you see. It's bloody and it's harsh, but it's nature and it's extraordinary. And so I think that sort of influences you. You know, you're asked sometimes like what influences you, and I think seeing anything beautiful, seeing anything that stays with you. I know that for me. There was a period of my time, and it was after my brother died, that I was having a hard time doing anything because he was like the most special person in the world to me. And I felt like, first of all, I stopped writing for a while, so maybe that sort of clogged something in me. But the other thing was that I felt like I needed to see some beauty every day if I could. And then you realize that it comes everywhere, you know, in a leaf, in a plant, and and I started to take stock of things like that because I think, what do we want to do here that's important? And so that was a part of it. And I think that I'm influenced by all the things around me. And I try my best to have those be beautiful things. And I think, and that's one of the reasons why, Grace, you don't get mad at me when I keep coming back to you, but the words come from where you hear them, where you see other people use them, how how they come to you. And I will tell you that in writing, and most writers probably have the same experience, when you're fluid, when it's coming the way it is, you use those words, and sometimes you have to look at the dictionary afterwards to see if you use them properly. You know, you're writing and it's there, and it pulls it out of you in a wonderful way. That's the best thing about writing, when it's working on paper. It's just you and your words. And then you're like, oh my God, did I know that word? I guess I did. So
your database is always working for you, Vales. And the thing that you're teaching us right now is the writer is a noticer. The writer sees every minute. The writer is always observing the world. Every minute is like living twice, because you get to have this rich world, then you get to have it again on the paper. And you're teaching us this when you're talking about the details that you see are the details in that book, because that book is rich with detail. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's the details that make things. I really do. I think that, you know, you could see a color, or you could see a particular blue that, you know, that's like the sky, but then it has they're just things that make you want to make sure the reader can see it the way you see it. And I think it's the words that do that.
For my own experience, to not know of your inner life and to know this editor who is impeccable, lovable, encouraging, adorable, if I may say, for working with you at the Washington Independent Review and just seeing you in the world, seeing you show up faces, then the book comes out and you say, I really didn't know this person. This person has, as I say, multitudes. Well, let's hear a couple more pages of the book, because everyone is going to want to get it.
Okay, now this part, I hope, you know, might amuse you a little bit. But I thought, and this is two women talking. And this is Selma, the main character, asking another woman, what would make a marriage last, she asked the old lady. Silence, bad hearing, ignorance of who the other is, and if you want it to last, you've got to just pretend that it's all right to live in a house and share your bed with a total stranger. As little conversation as possible, as much sex as possible. Again, that's if you like anything about him at all. If he's a sorry son of a, what might keep you going is elaborate fantasies on how to kill him. Are you still married, Selma asked, till the day he died, though I took my own name back. I've always been more Landry than anything. Thenia got up, walked around the garden again, found a larger rock, sat down next to Selma, made a more elaborate gesture, and threw the rock smack dab into the middle of the pool again. Swunkum, you must love your husband, Thenia figured and said so. I love the smell of trees, my mother's food, and probably Malti, who lived in my childhood with me, Selma said, and maybe the warm chill of what's to come from Clifton Thrace's body on mine, so quietly that Xenia didn't hear her. You think you might cook something anytime soon? You can get to him with those meals you've been making, Xenia said. I don't cook. Xenia looked over at the woman who had been cooking meals for weeks and wondered whether Negro women were plain weird. She remembered talk about Celsie and her grandmother being the best friend each other ever had. There had been lots of talk about Celsie and Xenia's growing up, odd talk. Celsie was two kinds of rice in one kernel, or all the rice blends in the same bag. Mostly talk about her amazing food. Surely this woman was Celsie's relative. One day she was making Celsie's amazing meals, and the next claiming she couldn't cook. First, she sang all day and never smoked. Then she smoked and never sang. Xenia looked at her. She did look kind of different, but she knew she was the same. Truth be told, Xenia didn't always feel the same way all the time either. Xenia's own mother had been moody. What would her children say about her? She chuckled to herself and knew she'd hang with whichever of these women wanted to hang out by her pool. You'd still be married to him even after he's dead, or even if he divorced you secretly and was living with some other lady in the next town. Plus, if he had anything, you get to keep it. Some of our best moments of marriage happened after he was gone, Dialandri claimed. Sometimes I'd run to the window and check to make sure he was still dead. He's in the pool, and from the top of the house with a flashlight, I used to try and see him anchored at the bottom with that giant rock I rolled to keep him there. Selma looked over at Xenia to see if she were making up stories. Even now, when I throw a rock in the water, I make all them wishes I couldn't make when I was little. First, I thank God that he's dead and that no one ever found out that I'd helped. Then I wished I'd known another kind of man just to see if it'd make me different. Then I throw rocks right in the middle to make sure none of his bones get to see the sunlight.
May I say, so much tells about you. Two kinds of rice in one kernel, two kinds of what? Now, okay, everyone, I just want you to hear that. Because every page is filled with such an imaginative simile or metaphor that she made up. She's not copying what she hears. Two kinds of rice in one kernel. That is what the kind of talk you're going to hear on every single page. What were you like at 5 years old, Vale?
You know, one of the funniest memories I have is being told to shut up all the time because I don't know how. I heard some opera or something, and I used to walk around, you know, and I heard an opera in another language, so I couldn't understand it, but I used to walk around trying to sing it, and he was like, will you please? I don't know why. This is the first time I've thought about that, Grace, in years.
Did you know that you were a prism when you were a child? Did you know that you were a little different from everyone else? That you were reflecting?
I think, you know why? I'll tell you what probably made me think more or at least spend more time. And I think that's all it is. It's because I'm the youngest in a family of four. And when I was, so my mother stayed home with the older three. And the middle ones are twins. And all of them went to school. And then my mother decided to go back to school too to get an advanced degree. And I was sent to my grandparents' house. And I remember, you know, not being happy about that, though loving them, because I was like, I could go to school just like the rest of them, because they would come home and teach me all the things that they knew. So I already knew how to read when I was three, and I knew things. It was all because of my older siblings. And I'm like, well, if I can do these things, why can't I go to school? And so, no, I couldn't. So I'd be at my grandparents' house. And my grandparents were very strict, so they wouldn't let me do anything. So I could go and sit on the porch, but I'd even have to ask to go from the porch to the yard. So, and at the time, the rest of my family, like I would stay with my grandparents. I feel like I would stay with them for a week and then go home for the weekends. And then the other thing is my grandmother was an evangelist, and she was a well-known traveling evangelist, and she also used to write. And so as a kid, I used to go on trips with her. So I went to Kentucky with her and spent some time in the mountains. I went to, you know, things like that. So I think being like this little person next to these, you know, next to my grandparents probably gave me a lot of time. And they also, you know, they'd make me sleep in the back room. So I'd have to go down this long hallway. And I remember being afraid, and I'd go down there and then jump onto the bed in case there were monsters beneath it. So I always had a bit of a, I always had a lot of imagination, always.
Everything that happened to you was a blessing. Everything that happened to you was a river going into the bigger stream. And I think Toni Morrison loves you. May I just say that? Toni Morrison.
Wouldn't that be lovely? Because I love her.
I know, but I'm feeling her. So I would like to have the audience hear one more page.
Summer McCombe was beautiful and crazy, though she didn't spend time in front of the mirror, talk to herself, have fits, or see things that weren't there. She had never had a breakdown. She suffered regular break-aparts, bits of her scattered everywhere like a Humpty Dumpty who could not put herself back together again. It was memory that left her in pieces, exploding in vivid flashes of the past, followed by a destructive residue, leaving ashes of the facts, making them altogether impossible to order in any serviceable way. Memory made up the person, which was Selma's riddle. She couldn't properly remember. She was merely one of five personalities housed in a single woman. Only one personality was present at a time, and Selma wasn't always in possession of her mind or body, not when the others each had their own turn. Her disorder had less to do with true madness than considerations of space and time. She was only available one-fifth of the time, and not by any ordinary scale or calendar. And yet, Selma had somehow intuited that the key to the fractured puzzle of now must be hidden in the odd reminiscences of then.
That is the voice of Vales Shepherd. May the world hear her and may the world applaud her. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on remote. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation, Sinipet Fund, Avidesha Shani, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and our engineer is Mike Turpin.